Welcome everyone to episode 2. We have with us Mo today, and Mo has got a bunch of questions that we're going to go through. All right, Mo, take it away.
Thank you, Vasily. Thank you. It's also nice to see you today. I was actually looking forward to this time, you know, just to share some of the experiences and some of these things that has been on my mind this week. For example, I was telling you about how, like, I was a bit stressed with, like, some of the things I was working on. And then I thought about asking you as well, like, when you feel this way at work, like, when you feel like some things that you think should go very quickly, it's not going very quick, and it seems like, oh, but it's not, like, supposed to be complex anyway. And how do you manage this type of, like, stress with, like, you know, expectations as well?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's oftentimes situations where you think something should just take like a few hours at most. And as you get into it, it starts opening up from all these unexpected angles and it's taking more time. And you're like in this permanent state of being like 98% done. It's like it's almost done. Every stand-up for like several days, you come in into the stand-up and you know somebody opens the Jira board and that ticket is still sort of hanging there. You're like, I'm 99% done. I'll get it out like a couple hours more and it'll be over. And then it's like day after day after day of going through this process. And it gets really frustrating because you know you feel like you're letting everyone down and you feel kind of incompetent almost because it's like, hey, you know, you told everybody you're going to be done several days ago and you're still working on it. And to you, you kind of feel like there's more and it feels really weird to admit that. And you get like, it's hard to come out and say, you know what? I thought it's going to take a day, but it's going to take like 2 weeks. Because if you say that, depending on your team and then your manager, it could range from like raised eyebrows to be like, oh my God, this guy is like completely incompetent, right? And so if you're in a team where it's limited by the raised eyebrows, that's fine. And I think once you're in that situation, either you kind of have to go that route and be like, okay, we have to address it once more. There's all these different things that are coming in that we haven't accounted for. It's pushing the timeline. I think the longer you try to pretend that everything's on time, the worse it's going to get. And so in the first half of it, you sort of like, well, you know, I'm almost done, so we can just stretch it out a little bit. And then in the second part of it, it's like, oh my God, I've been pushing it off for so long. And if I say now, because in the beginning you think, if I say something now that I need more time and then I'll have a breakthrough and finish it, it'll kind of be a little bit silly because then I have all this time and like, so. But in the second part, it's like, if I say I need more time now, it would be like, well, why didn't you tell us before? So now it's almost like this, you know, gambler's fallacy. You're like so invested into it. You feel like the breakthrough is going to come any minute. So like you don't want to make it known. And ultimately, I would say that it's like, in some cases, it can be like a developer issue, but a lot of the times I feel like it's planning issue. Like it wasn't adequately sized. It wasn't properly analyzed. There are gaps. The team did not think about all of the different things that could be coming into it. And maybe on a developer side, like maybe you haven't asked people who know the area and maybe they would have unstuck you quicker. So I don't think there's like a universal answer on how to deal with it. I think a lot of these things are sort of an opportunity for a learning moment where you can analyze it and try to figure out why it happened in each particular case. But the worst thing is probably try dragging it out. Because also, the longer you drag it out, the more stressed out you become. And the more stressed out you are, the more difficult it is to like maintain a cool head and maintain quality and attention to detail, because you have this inner voice that's like, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, we got to get it out, get it out, get it out, get it out. And so you're like, well, shit, I promised it a few days ago, and I don't have enough time for maintaining quality. So screw quality. I just need to get that ticket off my column in Jira. I'll do whatever, push it out, half finished, raw, without tests. Like, you start cutting corners where maybe the team is okay with finishing it later. And if you can analyze why, again, it's like a teaching opportunity for everyone. It's like, okay, what things did we miss in the analysis? What unknowns we have that we now know that are affecting it, right? So yeah, like don't hoard it all to yourself. Don't drag it out. And I would imagine a lot of people would treat it mentally as a failure, and they might even attribute that failure entirely to themselves. And in very rare occurrences, it is possible. Maybe like the person just doesn't know the technology when they think they did, and they've taken on this task, and maybe they were overconfident in it. But a lot of times it could be a planning thing, you know, or a knowledge thing, and saying, hey, let's revisit this. Let's analyze it in a little bit more detail. Here's the things that are preventing me from completing it. Let's figure out why they're there. Let's figure out what we can do about it. And, you know, that's just the reality of things. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. But keeping it in a state where you're just constantly stressing yourself out even more because of this thing is like, it's not going to work for everybody, you most of all. So don't do it.
So you would suggest to us, like, but you know, in certain situations, there's also like expectation. So for example, like, it's not, even if like you don't drag it, like you're not saying like you're 98% done in the team, in the daily meetings. Sometimes there's some level of expectation that comes with like your position in the team, and some tasks you are expected to take a certain amount of days, like it's just like an expectation. But and some other ones, sometimes it's like, you know, we can understand why it takes more time, probably because you have to talk to like other departments and like other things. Yeah, like explainable reasons. So like in reasons where, for example, let's say you were working with a certain API and somehow you needed more time to actually like understand what's going on with the API, but this is something that maybe they probably expected that, or you probably should have finished it. You probably should be able to understand it before starting working. So like this time wasn't calculated, you know?
Right. But okay, so you're putting in these terms like probably and expectations, and like why are those expectations set in the first place, and how do you gauge them? You just assume that somebody thinks you should have done it quicker than you're doing it right now. Like, is that a valid assumption, or is that or that is just some sort of self-conscious thing where you made that assumption about other people making assumptions about you? And now you're trying to work to that standard where in reality, like the standard hasn't been established that way. Mm-hmm. So is it a you problem overthinking it? Or is there like, if everybody on the team says, Mo, come on, you know, you promised that feature and it still hasn't been done, then you have a cause for concern. But if you sort of say where you are and what challenges you're encountering, I mean, everybody ends up in that situation, right? Like, if you have a developer telling you that he's never been in that situation, 99.9% certainty that he's lying, because everybody's been in that situation. Everybody understands what it feels like. And I think everybody can appreciate the situation. And okay, maybe you, you know, overpromised a little bit. It happens to everyone. And yeah, the other thing with expectations is like you have to adjust them every once in a while. Because I think we did have a conversation about it before. And it was like, if you go pedal to the metal 150% of your effort every single time, you create a very unhealthy expectation of what your output should be. Even though you can do it in a burst mode, you can do that kind of output for like a day. If you set up that expectation that you can do that output in a sustained fashion, that's just not going to work, right? You're going to burn out. So, I would probably clarify the actual expectations, like with your manager. You can have a one-on-one and be like, hey, in your opinion, like how am I doing? Like, do you think that I'm performing on a level, under, over? Like, what's like, how do you see it, right? Because that should give you a feedback of how they see it, hopefully, if they're giving you honest feedback. And you can kind of, in a lot of cases, they say, oh, you know, you're doing great, you know, everybody's pretty happy with what you're doing. And then you can just exhale and relax and readjust your own parameters about where your stress level should be in this particular situation, and your life is going to be much better.
Thank you. Actually, thank you, because you're right. It's probably a scenario that the expectation might not even be something from other people. I think it might just be mostly from myself, because I do put a lot of pressure on my own self to be at a certain level. And this is just a me thing, you know, just to push myself to keep a certain level of skill set. So maybe it is more of an expectation from myself than even from the team. So yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Vasily.
I mean, if you have an expectation from yourself, if you have an expectation from yourself, that's a good thing. Like you want to expect more from yourself. If you want to grow, right? You want to be in the mindset of, I could do a little bit more. I could do it a little bit better, a little bit faster. However, that should not stress you nearly as much as actual expectation from other people. It should give you some boost in what you're doing, right? Because, you know, you have high standards for yourself. That's fine. But I think it should be in the domain of motivation, because you are seeing your future goals versus demotivation and stress because of negative reactions of actual people around you, right? I think they're quite different. They both can motivate you temporarily, but you'd rather be motivated and not stressed rather than motivated and like super stressed, right? So I don't know if I'm explaining it, if I'm conveying the idea that I have in my head fully, but
yeah, actually, it's pretty good.
Yeah. Like, you don't want to be constantly good. Thank in a state you, of stress. Actually.
Yeah.
You want a moderate right. amount. I think, because, physiologically, a lot of stress is not doing good things to your body. So you want to avoid it, but you can't avoid it completely. And every once in a while, you need like a little shake to your system, just so it kind of like, oh, what's happening? I gotta wake up a little bit more. Like, you can't slide into just boredom, laziness, and complacency. You have to have good goals for yourself that are achievable, and work diligently on achieving them, and have motivation, and have different sources of motivation, but not like you know, it's almost like it can get disordered. Like, you know, some people who are, I don't know, maybe they're overweight and they wanting to lose weight, and now they're stressing super hard about the fact that they can't, and they get into this weird disordered patterns where they like become bulimic or something. And I mean, it's kind of similar. They just overstress themselves in their own head, and now they have like these massive physiological consequences. Whether if they gone about it in a slightly different way, they might have avoided the whole stress aspect, and just, you know, it would have been much better overall.
Yeah, actually, yes, because for me, maybe I might have been doing something like this to myself, but I think this is something I have to take some time to think about, to really like reflect on it and see how much of this type of stress I put on myself, and how I can actually like help to lessen it. Because yeah, you're right. You're actually right. It's like you can see through me right now. So,
well, yeah. I mean, we had these conversations before where it was about like too much self-consciousness in a sense, and prioritizing not even what other people think about you, but prioritizing what you think other people think about you over what you really are, and operating in that weird space, right? Like we had a conversation about, you know, feedback from other people is valuable, but that doesn't mean that feedback from everybody is valuable, right? Look, you have to filter the people who actually are, mm-hmm. you know, you would actually respect their opinions about you, because, you know, you have the reasons to do that. Like if some random person on the street tells me something about myself, I'll probably won't care. Even they could be even right, right? But like, who's that person? Why should I care about what they're saying, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Thank you, Vasily. I have another question that I wanted to ask you today. It was about like open source projects, you know? Like,
right.
For some time now, I've been looking into getting into other open source projects, like, because before I used to like really push, you know, in a few of them, but nowadays I'm thinking like, is this like free employment? Like because I get it. Like let's say in the beginning when you're starting out as a developer, it's really exciting to feel like, oh, you can really have like a real hands-on project to work on. But these days, it's starting to feel like everybody's going open source. Like, you want to build a project, you go open source. So now, you still have access to this project. You're just, like, making other people do it for you, technically. So to me, it's starting to feel like I don't understand the idea as much. And I was wondering, like, do you have any open source projects that you work on now? And how do you feel about it?
Yeah, right. Do you mean you working on a project of your own that you develop in an open source model, or you contributing to other open source projects that you might be interested in?
Yeah, contributing actually.
Okay.
Contributing to
Right. Well, I mean, it's only free employment. I mean, it is. You're writing code from which other people will get the benefit, but you will not be monetarily compensated in any way, likely.
Yeah.
So people usually do it for various reasons, right? Like there are people who have an idea about open source that, you know, it is worthwhile for humanity for the code to be open source and for people to be able to modify it and look at it, because it's like a net, they think it's a net positive for everyone. And I think broadly they're true in that regard. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about open source. And I wouldn't necessarily know where exactly I would fit. People would say, oh, you know, when a lot of people look at the code, they'll find bugs and things like that. It's true. If they look at the, if a lot of people look at the code, they're like more likely to find bugs. But for a lot of projects, like how many people are actually looking at the code instead of just grabbing the project and using it and never bothering to actually look? So I think it's still a good thing because you can learn from it. You can work on something and you can work in an environment that's going to be like different from what your company is doing, and like the modes of communication are going to be different. And you know, the quality requirements might be different. Like if you have time and if you have desire to contribute to open source, there's nothing really wrong with that. I wouldn't say that I myself like work on open source projects specifically, but recently I've been setting up a project which is, it's like an open core project with commercial aspects that you can self-host. And I was trying to run it on my system and I've encountered some issues, and in the desire to work out what's going on, you know, I went into the code and started reading it and started looking at it and identified a couple of things, which I posted to their bug tracker. I think I hit the point where I wouldn't be able to fix that stuff myself because the parts I'm looking at are like somewhere very deeply integrated. And if I start touching them, I'm not really sure what they're going to affect. And I don't necessarily have time to get into the whole thing and like understand exactly how it's built. So, I mean, to some extent, contributing bugs to a project could be considered contributing to open source. But again, you have to understand that there's like a wide spectrum of that, because some people come in and they put in a bug and say, your shit doesn't work, it sucks, it's garbage, you know, you're an idiot. Or some people could come in and say, I've encountered this thing that's triggered by these particular circumstances, and I think that this is where in code it happens, and this is how you can mitigate it. I maybe not know enough about it to do it myself, but here's a lot of details for you to reproduce it. So like the quality of the report varies greatly. I remember there was that a couple of years ago, GitHub did this thing where like you can get a t-shirt if you contribute to open source projects. And originally, they kind of poorly communicated it. And originally, basically, like every project qualified. And what it ended up happening is that a bunch of people just wanted a free t-shirt. So they started creating all of these garbage MRs all over the place. And people got really pissed off because, you know, if I'm a project maintainer and a PR comes in or a bug request comes in or something like that, I have to spend time and resources going through it and seeing, like, is it a real thing? Maybe I need to spend some time reproducing it. I have to go through code to see if it like applies to our standards. And so a lot of people got really mad about it because like this company's PR, I don't know if it was GitHub specifically, or it might have been like DigitalOcean. I think it might have even been DigitalOcean. They're like, oh, you can get a DigitalOcean t-shirt if you can prove to us that you're contributing to open source, blah, blah, blah. And people started just spamming these projects with these really garbage MRs that didn't really do anything. Like they would like change some punctuation somewhere or like fix a typo. And they would be like, some projects would be getting like tens and tens of these MRs. And everyone's like, what the hell's going on? Why all of a sudden, like all this weird activity that it's like not particularly valuable, right? So like, if you want to contribute, it has to matter and it has to be good. And unfortunately, and I think we touched briefly in our previous conversation, is that like the bullshit parts about software. I don't know if it's always been like this, but right now there's a lot of drama in open source world. And I think it's kind of balanced by, or propped up on different sides by two different things. Like on one end, there's maintainers who are like thankless, and they do this massive job, and you know, for some of them that's like their life. And on the other side, there's like these groups of people who just come in and spam there with the stupid requests or some minor bugs, or like give them grief about them like not fixing bugs, and like people burn out and they like flip the table, delete the repo and be like, screw you, I'm not doing this anymore. And like if you're contributing to open source, I would sort of want for people to understand the position of the maintainer and make sure that they're doing it in a way where they can look at it and be like, this looks really good, I can just click merge and be done with it, versus just saying, how come you haven't fixed what I asked you to fix, mister? By the way, I'm using your product for free, my company benefits from it, but you don't see a single penny out of that, but I demand you fix this thing, right? Like those kind of attitudes in these types of projects. Like, go read some bug reports on GitHub for some popular projects. You would be like, holy shit, like how dare these people have these demands like out of nowhere. I guess that doesn't really answer your particular question from the beginning, but like, you can contribute to open source in various ways, and you can contribute to it because maybe you find something that is bugging you specifically, or like you're using some tool and it doesn't support something that you want. And then, you know, you're being a man and you're going in and coding the feature and contributing it. And, you know, or maybe a lot of times too, what happens is somebody writes a feature that they want and they create a PR, and it could be a great PR. It could have documentation, tests, the code standards are followed, the code quality is high, but the maintainer says, you know what? I feel like this feature does not align with the goals of the project, and rejects it. And then the person submitting the PR, they're like, how dare you? I give you all of this excellent code and you just say no. And that's the other point of contention, is like the vision of that project is with the maintainer, and they could say no to you because they don't think that it adds to the overall thing. Maybe it dilutes the purpose, or it makes it more complex or something. They have their reasons, right? So you also have to be prepared for that situation where it's like, thank you, but we don't want it. Have a nice day, you know?
Yeah. Actually, like, that does not... Typically, like, it feels good when you contribute to an open source and you actually have your MR or PR merged, but... it's not, at least for me, it's not usually like the exact goal. For me, the main goal would be to be able to see other repositories, like other people's projects. Like for me, when I'm like choosing a project to actually go through, mm-hmm. I usually choose projects that I'm interested in, like something that I can do or like I would want to work on, you know? So like, if it gets merged, good. If it doesn't, good. It's like it has given me the opportunity to actually learn this thing. Understand? So like things I probably won't let at work, but maybe even skill that I would want to improve on, really, like that's usually my goal. So like, but I think you're right, like in the sense that it's a bit it could suck. Like let's say for example, if you are like connected to the project, to the tool, let's say it's a tool that you use and you expect to see your changes on the tool, you know, and you don't see it, that can hurt people, anyone's feelings. Like I get it, but personally that's usually not my goal. Like if it gets merged, fine. If it doesn't, then I guess then we'll see whatever happens. But the thing is, like, what I really wanted to know is like your own idea about like you know, when it comes to like the term open source itself. Like, do you feel like multiple people working on the project actually helps the project to move forward? So for example, like if you open source a project and you make it available for people to contribute, do you think it's a better development model? Or like, do you think, how do you feel about this generally? I just want to learn your your own feelings towards this idea, really.
Right. I mean, like, there's that book, The Cathedral in a Bazaar, which, like, talks about the different modes of software development. And, like, ultimately, you work on a project in a team of people, so there's multiple people looking at the code and making it better. So The only difference is in your case, only your team gets to see the code for it. And in open source world, everybody gets to see the code for it. And I think back in the day, a lot of people would be concerned about, oh, you know, our code is our intellectual property. And if we release it, people will just copy it and do whatever, and we'll be out of business. But, you know, in our previous conversations, we talked about how, like, nobody really writes bespoke things anymore. It's all just like glue and like a little bit of business logic. And, like, for most startups, it's not just the software that makes them successful. Software is enabling them on that path to success. But you can't just say, oh, if I'll write this piece of software, I'll automatically, my project will be successful and I'll be making lots of money, right? Because that's not really the case. Like, a lot of other things enter into delivering something that is successful and that brings company money. So maybe for some people, like, open sourcing some of it isn't that big of a concern. And plus, a lot of the companies also, they sort of start selling their stuff through cloud-based systems. So it's like, you access the software differently, like you never really run it on your own computer and stuff like that. So I think that, I don't really think that there's anybody who can say, oh, open source is definitely a bad thing and nobody should be doing it. Or at the same time, nobody can really say, well, closed software is a bad thing and no one should be doing it. Like, I don't know. I think that the fact when open source came onto the scene, because, like, back in the day, you buy your hardware from a vendor and you buy all of your software from that vendor, and you're locked in for life into these massive contracts, and any kind of change, you have to go through ton and ton of bureaucracy and millions of dollars and years of time for these things, right? And so some people looked at that and said, like, that's just really silly. Like, how come it has to be like this? Why can't we just develop it in a more open fashion where people can contribute directly if they wanted to? And I think that it did change the world of computing in general, and it given a boost to the entire industry in a sense, because one of the side effects, it's not even that it's open source or closed source. It's more of the fact that most open source things at the start of the era were free, both as in speech and free as in free beer. Like, you could just get it and run it for free and not have to pay anyone anything. And so if I'm an aspiring enthusiast and I want to build something, like we talked about it in our previous conversation, it's like, oh, if I want to write an application for Windows, I have to pay several thousands of dollars for MSDN subscription to get the compiler and the libraries and the header files and the documentation. And if I am just a guy, I don't have those kind of resources, I cannot enter into this field this way. Whereas with open source, here you go. You know, you can download the operating system, you can download the tooling, you can build the programs. And I think a lot of it, you kind of felt grateful that open source idea has enabled you to build the things that you want to build. And in the spirit of that, you would then open source your tools because, you know, you got there this way and now you're paying it forward by open sourcing your stuff. But eventually, what happens to a lot of projects? Like, a lot of projects, they start, they get started by an enthusiast that builds a tool, and then that tool gets some degree of adoption, And they're like, okay, well, now I've been spending all this time on it. Like, how can we commercialize it? Right? Like, a lot of, like, for instance, GitLab originally was like a hobby project, I think. And now eventually it's like, well, now we have this commercial offering, and now we have like this enterprise edition, and like you can still get the free version and run it yourself, but there's this enterprise license. So a lot of the tools that become really popular, they kind of go for that dual licensing model where you can get some features in an open version, or if you want to have like a commercial support, or if you want to be able to run this software for commercial gain, you then have to license it from the vendor. So it's still open source, just like different monetization schemes. Some of them do work, some of them don't really work. And Tana software is fully open, and usually they end up being supported by various organizations or sponsors. And there's no guarantee that, you know, open source will bring you monetary success, but it could bring you recognition and respect of your peers for sure. But a lot of times it's a very, very difficult job. You have to be very dedicated to it. And you have to be dedicated to it, not with hopes of like, oh, you know, eventually I might commercialize it. It's kind of like we talked about it. It's like kind of like starting a podcast. You know, the first 50 episodes where you have 3 views per, and you have this goal in mind. But if you're like too focused on like, how come it's not making me money yet, you're probably not going to be making very good stuff, because you're like focusing on different things. And then when you eventually hit success, it's like, oh, I can actually make something from it, which is kind of an added bonus.
Yeah. But do you think like open source projects, if it's open source and people, so for example, you made a reference to like, right now you work in a team and everybody contributes to a certain repository, and it's just your team that have access to it. So this team actually get financial compensation for their contribution to the project. But in an open source project where everybody, the public, can actually contribute to a project, I think some open source, not because it is, I don't think like everybody can contribute to open source project. I'm not too sure. I think some projects actually have like a condition somehow. But let's say everybody can contribute to it. Do you think like open source projects should be made with the aim of making financial gains? So for example, because if that's the idea, then it means like the people that have actually contributed to this project should also be compensated if you are thinking of the project as for profit.
So, okay. I think the main idea about open source, like if you think about it from like Richard Stallman perspective, is you should be able to see how it's made. You should be able to modify it. And the other very important aspect of it is that if you're not satisfied with the direction in which the maintainers are taking the project, you can fork it and have your own copy and do whatever you want with it. Right. So that's kind of the main idea about open source, is that if you don't like it, fork it, make it your own, which happened a bunch of times. Right. And in terms of whether open source is, if it's commercialized, are people entitled to the portions of that? I think if you have, depends on the license. Originally, if it's something like GPL, I think the answer is no. And a lot of times for big open source projects, as you said, like you can't just join, you have to submit some sort of release saying like, I give my rights away to the maintainers, to the entity that oversees the project, and you basically give it up. So yeah, I don't think that the open source for an individual contributor, if you're contributing to somebody else's project, that's only because you like it. You know, there's a guy on YouTube, And he posted this video about him unclogging drains on highways in the United States. Like, he just does it for fun, even though it helps a lot of people when he does it, because there's like a flooded road and cars can barely pass. And then he comes in with like a rake and like the waders and like all this equipment and starts like cleaning out the drains, and then the water drains out and, you know, the cars can pass. And like, nobody's making him do it. Nobody's paying him to do it. Maybe he gets like, he gets hundreds of thousands of views now, so maybe he's monetizing it through YouTube, but like, he's doing it because he wants to do it. So like, if you want to contribute to open source because you want to do that, just like, who's there to stop you? If you want to have open source product to make money with it, it's possible. You need to build something that people will want to use. And normally the way you monetize it is by giving them a convenience. It's like, sure, you can self-host it on your own machine, or you can pay us a tenner a month and we'll host it and support it for you. And for me, I would like to run it myself, because if anything happens, I still have my copy and it's running, and now any kind of disruptions, if that service is disrupted because of my own fault, that's on me, right? And if the original vendor decides to stop doing it and say, sorry, we're shutting down, I still have my own. But for other people, they may be like, well, we like the functionality, but we don't want to deal with all of this hosting business, so let's just pay them and use it, right? But like, it has to be something that people actually want to use. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but yeah, I think the fact that it is open source, I don't know if it directly correlates to its ability to bring profit. Like, I've seen successful open source projects, and there's a ton of successful closed source projects. And there's also a bunch of unsuccessful in like commercial aspect open source projects. They just there. And, you know, if some library on NPM is only being used by like 10 people a month, is that a success or a failure? Like, I don't know. You tell me. I think that.
Well, that's NPM.
But so what? Like, you see, that's the thing too. Like, there are closed repository. Like, people are trying to monetize NPM packages. Like, for instance, mm-hmm. there was this guy recently who's maintaining this library called Core.js, which is used mm-hmm. as this sort of compatibility shim to get on like the latest technologies. If your browser is old, Core.js would polyfill all the new cool things that the language offers that you don't yet have, so you can like enjoy all of the features. And his project is basically being included by everyone. And he was saying, oh, you know, my family is experiencing financial difficulties right now, but like, nobody's really supporting Core.js. Like, there's no corporate sponsors. Mm-hmm. There's barely any people donating through mm-hmm. like GitHub support. And if my financial situation doesn't change, I might end up having to stop maintaining it just because I can't afford to do so anymore. So that can also happen. And it's a wildly successful in terms of numbers of dependencies that depend on this library and like number of weekly installs, crazy successful from those metrics, not making guy any money to the degree that he says, well, I can't sustain this. I might have to step away from this project entirely, right? And it's like a critical piece of infrastructure. But if he had the intention of, I'll have this compatibility layer and I charge everybody for it, his adoption might have been nil. Because how would you even convince people that they have to pay for it, right? It's this balancing act that is weird. Sometimes you get lucky and somebody wants to pay you for it, or you do proper business analysis and you figure out a way to monetize it, which for libraries, it's very difficult. Like, there have been these places where it's like, oh, it's like NPM, but you know, you pay some monthly subscription fee that gets divvied up between the people whose libraries you're using, and they're not seeing too much adoption either. Because if I'm an enthusiast and I have to pay somebody for some library, I'd be like, I probably won't. I'd rather find something else. Maybe it's going to be of inferior quality, but then I don't have to bother paying for it. Or maybe the functionality is such that I can trivially implement the required bits myself and just not bother. So on a library side, monetizing libraries is really difficult. I think the only successfully monetized libraries that I know of is like in game design, they have these libraries for like, I don't know, like network stack programming or like some animations or physics simulations or things like that. But because usually they build products that are commercial products, they get like a percentage of every sale. So those types of libraries, or like, for instance, the Qt framework, you know, Qt, like the application interface building, like they're very successful commercially because a lot of their stuff is used in like car embedded entertainment systems. Like all of those UIs, or a lot of those UIs are usually written using Qt. And so, you know, they're monetizing it that way. But at the same time, they have like open source editions. So if you're running KDE as your desktop of choice on Linux, it's all going to be Qt, and hey, there's an open source version, right? So, but they're kind of a juggernaut, and they're very, very comprehensive. So they're able to license it commercially, and good for them. But if you're just an NPM package vendor that does something slightly less trivial, good luck monetizing that. Like, people are not going to bother most of the time.
Yeah, I know, like, I've always wondered if these people, like, that make libraries, like NPM libraries, I always wondered if they actually get monetized, or like, they just do it out of like pure passion, because I just guess, yeah. I just wonder, but yeah.
I think so the best
probably
way,
just passion.
Yeah, it is, and I think a lot of times, so like, I pay Fiverr a month to a guy who's writing this library, because I think it's a great library, and I think that he should be getting something out of it. And a lot of times you would find some successful internet company that's using your tool and be like, guys, you're building, like, the library is open source, it's licensed in a way that it's free to use, but you know, you could sponsor it too, because it's like powering so much of your business. It would be, and again, it's not like a demand, right? It's more of a like, it would be a nice thing to do if you as a company that's building a lot of tooling on my library would sponsor me. So it's not like a commercial license, but it's more of a, you know, like give it back. And these things are not guaranteed. Like if you can end up in such an arrangement, great, but it can also end at any time. So, yeah.
Yes. Honestly, I just feel like maybe there should be, based on the amount of work that I know it takes to build libraries like this, I think people should be compensated for it. But I'm thinking this is NPM's business, maybe they should think about it, because at least like to make other people want to contribute, or maybe these people that manage these libraries get something different. Maybe they get access to data, some form of data that they can, I don't really understand, but it doesn't sound very fair to me that they do all this work and they just do it out of passion. But maybe it's just an area that I'm not very, very familiar with, so I don't really know the details of how things happen around there. So, but it'd be nice.
I think the other thing about it is that, remember in our last conversation, I was saying about how there is some stuff that I used to do because I wanted to, and now I do because I have to. Like, as soon as you have commercial aspect to it, now you have to. Like, you have to maintain it. You have to take bug reports seriously. You can't just say, you know what, I don't care. Because if people are paying you money, they will have way more expectations, right? And like, now you have to. And for a lot of people who write code, that's also a turnoff. Because, you know, I wrote something that I find useful and I published it on NPM, and I'll never touch it again. It's open source, but, you know, I no longer have any interest in it. And if something is paying me money for it, now it's like part of my life, whether I want it or not. So you have to kind of think about it from what people want. Like, if it ends up being commercial software, then it's probably worthwhile like forming a company around it and actually having. But it's like, would you start making enough money to afford building a company around it and hiring people to maintain it? And like there's that chasm that's really difficult to cross. Like, if you manage to get a lot of money when you can like bootstrap it right away, and then it becomes self-sustaining without your direct input, then maybe. But if it's just you and you're getting, I don't know, like $300 a month out of it, and now people have all of these demands, like, is it really worth your while, right? The amount of hassle, is it proportional to the amount of money you're getting out of it? And so I think a lot of times you wouldn't be able to reach to that level where it's actually financially completely worthwhile. Like, you can quit your day job over it. I think that for these types of projects, it's very hard. Or if it's very promising, what usually happens is you find investors and then they dump a bunch of money into it and you try to commercialize it. And then 98% of the time, it fails entirely. So, you know.
I don't know. I think like NPM is a, you can liken it to like a content, imagine it as a container for a lot of libraries. That's what it, like, and if you look at some of the models for like social media, for example, and you see like people that actually consider themselves creators for these social media companies actually get compensated, because without the content, the people don't have to go there. Like, what makes NPM NPM is because of the libraries that it contains.
Right.
So like, if you have people being compensated for, even if it's not a lot of things, if compensation is per downloads or like something, you know, it encourages people to want to maintain these libraries. It encourages people to want to contribute to the libraries. And I think at the end of the day, we'll randomly just have a better NPM. At the end of the day, it's true, you can leave it in a model where like you find something useful, you just put it there and it just, yeah, but that means like if you have like over a million libraries in NPM, like 50% of them might just be garbage then. So like you just have garbage libraries.
Yeah, there's a ton of garbage libraries like, there that nobody cares about.
Yeah, so but like
so what? Like, it's just because it has a lot of garbage, like it does have a lot of, but like at the same time, like App Store for iPhone, like 80% of it is probably garbage, if not 90%. Like it's just people trying to get on the hype train, hoping to monetize something, and a lot of times it's garbage
but that nobody
cares. Yeah, but well, because.
It's different
from the beginning, because App Store from the beginning, the whole point is that you can sell your apps. You can get money for your apps. NPM was never you can get money for your libraries. And I think it will never be. I don't think that any package repository for any language was ever for the purposes of making money. And I don't think that any of them will ever become that. It's just not gonna happen. the adoption of paid libraries through that model, I just don't see it, to be honest. Because unless that library does something so well that you can't get it anywhere else, and those are few and far between. For most part, it's like what would happen if React said, oh, you have to pay us license fees to use React? 90% of people would be like, well, fine, I'll switch to Preact or Solid or something else. And they'll just stop using it. And like, because, okay, like they can't retroactively say you have to pay us for even old versions of React. They can only say like, okay, the new version of React is now like changes licenses. And even then they can't trivially do that either, right? Because they have to get all of the contributors to get them to reassign their rights. Maybe they already do. I don't know how it works because it's like from Facebook. But if Facebook said React is now a commercial library, most of the people would likely either stick on whatever they're using currently and never bother upgrading to the new version, or they just quit altogether and be like, well, yeah, well, good luck. Good luck getting any money from us. So, and I don't know, maybe for Facebook even, they could be using React internally, or at the same time, it could be like this vanity project that they have a team of people that they pay money for, but it's not making them any money, right? It might make them money because they're using it internally and building all of their products using it. So in that way, it kind of like through some sequence of steps makes them money. But I'm pretty sure on the balance sheet, the React team is like, loss leader. They just don't make any money. They just spend money. It's hard to quantify. And so, yeah, unless you're something where you can sell to the big enterprise and provide support for it, I just honestly don't see it. Like companies like Trolltech, which produces Qt, they do it. Like if you're building some game engine related stuff, they do it too. Everything else, if I have to pay in advance before I even understand whether it solves my problems or not, to me, it's just non-starter.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. The only reason why I was sharing the mod, like I was asking about the mod, I was just curious about like how people can be motivated to contribute to these things. But I get you. But you know, another thing that, it's just passion, you know, like, and which is valid, actually.
Well, like, you can just have this type of passion. If we were to assume that anybody is doing anything just because they're motivated by money, that would be completely incorrect, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some people in this world who do things just because they're motivated by money. But I think a lot of people do things because they're motivated by other things, right?
That's correct. But, you know, like in this sense, like there are other things that motivate. We all have different things that motivate us in life. But in this kind of, in this model, like I felt like, so for example, if I'm to do it and I would need to, probably some resources to actually like, you know, time, whatever I need to work. And then I build a library. And for me to continue to make it good, make it relevant for several years, it will take some work. It will take some work, not just like sleep and press a button, you know? And to make it relevant, you know? So, but you gave a really good example of React. Finally, React is also one of the libraries. And I don't imagine people having to pay for React to use React, but that would be interesting. But I understand you. It's just, I was just thinking about it based on like, you know, from a personal perspective, like, you know, in long term.
If somebody came up with React like 20 years ago, they probably could have licensed it commercially and would have been very successful with it. So I think the time right now, the state of the industry is such that a lot of these things are just not gonna work out the same, where everything's like commercially have to have licenses for everything. So anyway,
yeah, but it is what it is. Anyway, so another thing I wanted to ask you today is about ethical consideration. You know, like each industry have different each industry have like what they consider to be like the ethics of the industry. In ours, have you ever had an instance where ethical considerations had a significant impact on a software project that you're working on?
That is a really interesting question. I think that I haven't really personally worked on anything of that caliber where there would be very kind of palpable ethical considerations. Like I always kind of remember about all of the failures of software that it resulted in loss of life or some sort of disfigurement or damage. And that always like really that stuff kind of scares me in a way. Well, obviously, like for instance, the project, it was like a French project for radiological equipment for like X-ray machines, and some coding error made it so that it delivered like way more radiation than necessary, and people like suffered health consequences because of that. And that was like a software error. Or some rocket exploding because like some conversion wasn't done correctly and the sensor information was not interpreted correctly and it exploded. Thankfully, I don't work in such industries where I have to sort of think about these things. Like this is on like the very, very top side of it. It's like if you make mistakes, people will actually die. I probably would never really want to work in such an industry. Just, you know, I know my limits, you know, let's put it at that. So, however, there are other considerations that are definitely ethical considerations. And I think that how to formulate it. Okay, so we're making websites that hundreds of thousands of people use every day, right? And if we introduce some amount of latency into how quickly our page loads or how slowly our page loads, like if we make our page load slower by, I don't know, quarter of a second times 200,000 visits is a lot of time in aggregate, right? So like, we set back humanity by that many seconds in one day that could have been spent on something else, right? Is that an ethical consideration? Like, I think it is, you know? Like, if you make your software slower and your software is being used by millions of people, that slowdown times millions of people is a lot of time that is not being spent on other productive endeavors. I know it, like, if you think about it, like, oh, what's a quarter of a second of me, like of the page opening slower, but you know, it's it accumulates like that amount accumulates across every website that person goes. If that website is not optimized to its utmost potential, it's stealing seconds of people's lives one millisecond at a time, right? So there is an ethical consideration there. At the same time, you could also say, well, you know, we can afford big, beefy computational instances in the cloud, so we don't have to be like the software developers in the 80s, where they have to count every byte of memory lest they blow it out by one or two and won't fit into the constraints that they have. we don't have to optimize that much. We can just afford to get a bigger instance, and then bigger instance translates into it's consuming more electricity, it's consuming more electricity and cooling because it runs hotter for longer. And so the electricity that could have potentially been used for other things now goes into the data center, and where we write unoptimized code that runs like garbage and we don't care. And like, if we weren't running this code, I'm not saying that, because even if we write super optimized code, something is going to find something else to saturate those servers. So maybe that part of it is not exactly accurate. But still, I think the time thing is a big one, because, you know, for people, time is finite. And once it's lost, it's lost.
Of course, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, if you make something slow, less usable, that creates a lot of frustration. Like, if it's being used by one person, then maybe that's fine. But if it's being used by hundreds of thousands of people, in aggregate, that's a lot of loss. So, but a lot of people don't really think about it in terms of ethics. They would not say, oh, it is unethical to make slow software because it deprives people of their time. It's just not something that they don't think about it in such terms. Other aspects of it. And I also think that people kind of go into these weird avenues, which they think that they are ethical concerns, but they're kind of overhyped. I don't know specifically about software, but it's like, let's ban all plastics because there's this piece of plastic garbage patch in the ocean somewhere, and it's really terrible, and it's kind of, so let's get rid of all the plastic. And they basically have a crusade against it. But if you think about it, if we ban all plastic, life as we know it would end. We'll be reverted back like hundreds of years in terms of our development. So it's kind of weird that way. I think in software, it's a little bit less prevalent. Like, if you're building some website in darknet where, you know, some sort of deviants upload weird pornographic materials involving minors, there's massive ethical implications to that for sure. But, you know, most people don't do that. And those who do, I wouldn't know their reasons necessarily. Maybe money, maybe fear or something. So it's hard to say.
But let's say, I get like the aspect of ethics that you're looking at, but another one I wanted to touch on is like, let's say you work for a company in a project, and you know that this project actually has a potential to be used maliciously. Say, for example, like maybe, you know, in a way that you don't really support. Maybe when a user interacts with, say, something happens, which I don't really want to describe really, but like, you get what I'm trying to say, like, you know. Mm-hmm. But you're already in this company, and then you have signed the contract. How would you feel or react to this type of scenarios? Would you be the whistleblower, or would you just like quit and walk away? Or you would be like, I mean, I know some people would also be like, well, it is a job. You have to do what you have to do, and then you continue your life. This is more like a personal conviction, but I'm curious to how you would feel about this type of thing, and how you would advise someone else.
I think it is
in this type of scenario. Yeah,
you're right. It is like a personal conviction, and it's up to person's moral position in this world, right? And you know, you can be motivated. There could be a lot of different factors. And some of those factors might be very pertinent. Like, if that's your only job and you have to pay your mortgage and support your family, and, you know, you have to have this job at least for the time being, and if you quit it, the consequences to you and your family are going to be very real immediately, that makes it a really difficult decision. Because you're sort of weighing some potential harm to some unnamed group of people sometime in the future versus concrete harm to immediate family right now, right? And you would say this outweighs the other, because this is, first of all, it's a potential, it's not a guaranteed. But obviously, contributing to it would increase the probability of it actually happening. And the person needs to make that decision for themselves, right? I can't say, oh yeah, you must quit your job, because like I'm not in that situation. And if I were in that situation, I would have to think very hard and very long about what the best course is and how strong my convictions are and whether or not I'll be, you know, regretting it later on. Like, if I'm on my deathbed and I'm reflecting on my life, would that thought that I should have quit that place because I stayed and something bad has happened because of it, like, is it gonna be there in my final hours? And would that like define my life in a way? And it's really easy to speculate about these things, but in a specific instance, it's really hard. Like, it's a really difficult question. I remember like not considering even talking to a company because they were doing some type of product that involved like DRM restrictions, and I said like I prefer not to work on projects that involve DRM, and I hung up the phone, and that was that. But you know, that didn't mean that they were like offering me a job at the time. They just reached out and it's like, yeah, I prefer not to work on that. Mm-hmm. I haven't been in a situation where the company, because it's not even necessarily ethical considerations, maybe. Like, maybe the company is doing something you disagree with. Maybe you think it's immoral. Maybe mm-hmm. it does not align with your views, your political views, your religious views. You don't agree with it. Like, mm-hmm. what should you do? Should you quit? Should you call them out? Should you be a whistleblower, as you said? There is no universal answer to that. It's more of a, like, understanding the consequences of all of those choices and your willingness to deal with those consequences. Like, if you quit and you don't have any money to feed your family, it's definitely a consequence. And the thing is, though, a lot of people might say, oh, if I quit, I will have no other job. And I think that's a fallacy, because like, that's not necessarily true, that if you quit this company, you will not have any other job. Like, you found this job somehow. Thankfully, right now, at this point in time, economically, we're not in a situation where you have to hold on to your job at all costs. Maybe for some people that is also true. Maybe they think that, you know, they've ended up in a place, and if they somehow lose that place, that would be it. It's also possible. So ultimately, you have to look at the consequences and your willingness to deal with them. And if you're willing to deal with them, and you think that in the future, looking back, you would look at it and say, I made a right decision, then go for it. Like, I never reached that point in time where I would have to put it all on a line. And in some ways, I hope I never would have to. So I guess we'll see. I haven't been through it personally to have like that kind of experience where my moral convictions would tell me that I have to leave. A lot of times I think about it quite a lot, especially these days, because you know, the political and cultural situation in Western countries is really weird right now. It's like really weird. Like go back 10 years, it was completely different compared to now. And a lot of companies do a really weird things that I don't personally appreciate. And I don't know if my company decides to go all in and I would have to be personally involved, I am leaning toward the fact that I would just say, no, screw yourself, I quit, right? But at the same time, if that happens and our government decided to hike the interest rates and now my mortgage is so much that like I have to pay it, what do I do then? Like, I don't want to lose my house. So like, it's a very difficult choice. And I don't know, thankfully, we're not in a situation where we're like in some massive war and I have to make a choice upon which like actual people's lives are at stake. the stakes are considerably lower at this point. And so I can speculate about it,
yeah.
But like, I don't know when it's time to kind of put your money where your mouth is, what would I do? I hope I do the right thing, you know? I really hope I do the right thing. And I've been thinking about these scenarios. And yeah, I hope I do the right thing.
But if you say you hope you do the right thing, that means it's the right thing to do.
Well, yeah.
It's relative.
I think that if we're not like I'm not one for moral relativism, and I think that there are things that are definitely good and there are things that are definitely bad, and I would say so that
in this case,
like I would probably quit.
So in this case,
I don't know
if say...
I would do whistleblowing or something, I would probably quit.
Okay, fair enough. That's what I was thinking too. Like, I imagine I put myself in this type of situation. And actually, I feel like I have been in one before, something like this. But this has been a while ago. I just to avoid giving so many details about the company, but I felt like it took advantage of a certain demographic of people. I felt uncomfortable just about it, you know, just knowing that even though I'm not doing the bad deed directly, but I am facilitating it in my own way. So I felt guilty, but I think I left within like the first 2 weeks or so. I just couldn't handle it. But it was easy for me to make this type of decision because it was easy for me because I don't have responsibility to other people. I'm only responsible for myself. At the time, I was only responsible for myself. So like you said, when it comes to like other things included, say like your family or like your other bills that you have to pay, which is like everybody's looking out for. So it becomes complex, right? So I understand.
Yes. That's why you wonder, do all like... your activism in your 20s when you don't have anybody dependent on you. Then you can be as crazy as you want and, you know, write manifestos and, you know, run with crowds and nobody is going to be affected except for you most of the time. But as you get further in life, you know, and you acquire various things, it becomes more difficult to, you have to weigh the outcomes very carefully because other people's lives are now dependent on it.
But I think it makes it even worse. You know what? Just this is my idea, right? I think it makes it even like more complicated if you don't leave, because you're just knowing yourself that you keep doing, you're doing something wrong, and you keep doing it every day. That have a lot of impact on your own conscience. I mean,
yes,
this is something I say just because I believe like we all have conscience. Everybody should. Some people don't really believe in it, but I do. So like, I think it affects your conscience a lot. And if you lose your conscience for money, I don't think it's worth it. Like,
yeah, it depends on the amount of money.
At the end of the day, how much money do you think? But this is just my opinion, you know. And like you said, like, you know,
see, I don't know.
It might be different.
The amount would be different for every person, right? So, yeah. This is the kind of question that if you really start asking yourself where the lines lie for you on various subjects, it can get pretty uncomfortable pretty quickly, right? Because I think a lot of people like to say that they're good, but if you inquire deeply about some of the things, you might realize that, you know, in some aspects you're not really that great. You know, you'd be like tolerating some things that other people wouldn't tolerate, or close your eyes and look away and wash your hands off something where you know it's not the right thing to do. Like, it's a human condition, right? We're not perfect in any way. And yeah, it's a really tough, like, I would hope that nobody would have to find themselves in this situation, but people do. And I will probably find myself in that situation eventually. And yeah, all I can think about is that I have the resilience and the resolve to do the right thing ultimately.
Fair enough. So yeah, this is all the questions I have for you today. And once again, I want to thank you firstly for your time and for sharing all your experiences about all these things. I've learned a lot today, and especially the part where I have to take a self-reflection on my own self to learn more things about the expectations that I put on myself, which is something, and also like a lot about open source projects. It's always like good, like talking with you, and I enjoy it. So I'm gonna see you again next week.
All right, we'll be seeing each other next week. And thanks everyone for stopping by.